This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Was transforming the country. The problem with that narrative was that, in essence, there were still about 60% of the country living in poverty, and in fact, there were two Venezuelas, the real Venezuela that lived in the shadow of the oil economy and comprised the majority of the population, mostly people of color, and the other part of Venezuela, which was a highly educated, very mobile, and very energetic middle class saw itself as the beneficiary of oil and its the profits and its privileges. And those two Venezuelas really clashed and have been the forces behind the polarization in the country. And the election of Chavez then transforms all previous political narratives and all previous political arrangements, because here you have what everyone had been trying, what many people had tried to negate in Venezuela. You had a person who had African and indigenous background assuming the presidency, claiming to represent the poor, and claiming to chart a different course in Venezuela. In fact, you saw that very clearly what his inauguration about the constitution of Venezuela, he said it was a moribund document and proposed that the country should draft a new constitution. So in essence, we see then the real chasm here, the real clash here between the two visions of Venezuela.
And with Hugo Chavez, I mean, one of the things that gets said out there in mainstream media is, well, he lucked out. It was an oil boom, so he was rolling in oil dollars, and he lavished those not too carefully on the poor. And of course, he's going to become more popular. But you know, I look at that and I say, well, it's an oil boom for all countries, and are they all lavishing it on the poor? I don't believe so.
No, they're not. In fact, Venezuela, I mean, here you U.S. has oil, yet the U.S. not own its own resources. Venezuela had nationalized oil in 1976, but even though it had nationalized oil long before Chavez, the company, the oil company, operated as if it was part of a foreign conglomerate, so that it saw itself housed in Venezuela, but really wasn't beholden to problems in Venezuela. And what Chavez does is try to transform that. Let me underscore, when Chavez comes to power, the barrel of oil was $7 a barrel. That's not lucking out. That's actually facing a cost that really are very insurmountable, because in fact it costs more to produce oil. Which the first thing Chavez did was try to reconnect with OPEC. Venezuela is a founder of OPEC in 1960. So he traveled to the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Iraq, and the opposition laughed at him, saying he was cohorting with terrorists, because the U.S. had embargoed many of these countries. So that in fact he set out to rebuild OPEC and to increase the price of oil within a bandwidth of about $30, $35 to $38. Beyond that, oil increased due not to Chavez, but due to speculation by large companies in the U.S. and elsewhere. So
Did he not also have some of the oil reserves that were in Venezuela? Weren't they miscategorized to appear to be more expensive to extract?
Yeah, they were miscategorized because what was being run was really a scam. The Venezuelan oil company, PDVSA, was a notorious violator of the OPEC rules. OPEC had assigned Venezuela a quota. So Venezuela was selling oil under the OPEC quota and then selling what it called oil shale on a side agreement to major U.S. corporations at a reduced rate. So they were getting a tremendous profit off of what they called oil shale or bitumen, but in fact was heavy crude that could be transformed into oil. So yes, they were actually speaking out of two sides of their mouth, but making profits in ways that undermine OPEC, and what Chavez did was to bring it all under. And that's what led to the coup in 2002 against him by the opposition, which was green-lighted by the U.S., and that's also what led to the national oil stoppage by the managers in 2002 in December. And it wasn't really until 2003 and 4 that the government reclaims control of the oil company and lost in the process something like $14 billion. So it wasn't simply luck. It was a matter of actually trying to develop the structure by which the country could reclaim its resources and then gear those towards social investment.
Just that recategorization can mean endless, well, probably billions of dollars to the people of Venezuela or to the nation of Venezuela, because that means that it's a lot easier to get out and they can do it at a lower price point, therefore. So one of the things that we know about, you mentioned the coup. That's a coup, for people who had loved to see a movie, I think was very good backgrounding this. It's The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. You can look that up in Google. But I saw that movie way back then, and it was very clear that They tried to pull an Aristide. I don't know if Aristide had already had that happen to him, but what they did in Haiti, which is they came in and kidnapped him and his family and said he resigned. And that's what they attempted to do with Hugo Chavez. And I'm wondering how important that was in actually increasing his popularity, because it's the masses of people, and literally, I believe there are millions, who came out into the streets that were responsible for him being brought back to power.
And that was very critical, because in 2002, the opposition once again had underestimated Chavez, because they thought it was only him. It wasn't just about Chavez. The reality was, it's about the fact that there was social discontent in Venezuela, and new sectors of society had been empowered. Social movements, organizations of Afro-Venezuelans, women, indigenous, urban dwellers, the urban poor, those people are the ones who brought Chavez back to power, because they had invested themselves in this government, and because they had been empowered by this government. So this is the first time, you had many coups fail in Venezuela, but this is the first time in which an elected president had been ousted and then brought back by the population and elements within the military who did not want to see a break in the constitutional order. But you're right about the resignation thing. It was done to Aristide, it was done to Chavez, and it was also done to Zelaya in Honduras. The notion that somehow it's not a coup if you get them to sign a paper that says they resign, when in fact they have not resigned.
Yeah, get them to sign a paper at gunpoint. Literally, or, you know, with the target of the United States on their back, I mean, putting in crosshairs of the United States. Let's talk about the impact of those oil dollars and how the country began to reorganize to get those dollars to the poor. I mean, I know that you talk about poverty being reduced. How was that accomplished?
It was accomplished in two different ways, because it was not just the reduction in poverty, but it was also the increase in standard of living. So you have a series of social missions, increases 60% in social spending by the government from its budget, and much of that coming from the oil profits. And so what happens is you have a series of programs called misiones, or social missions, the first of which was medical mission called Miss Barrio Adentro, which was towards the neighborhood, which essentially provided doctors into poor neighborhoods, clinics to deal with basic treatments and also prevention, under which people actually, for the first time, saw a doctor, were able to be seen by medical. And this then grew into Misión Barrio Adentro 1, 2, and 3, and eventually covered not only immediate injuries, but also long-term care as well. Then you had educational missions to try to abolish illiteracy. Then you had those who didn't finish high school and secondary, and then opening up new universities for those who wanted access to universities, increasing the number of students going to universities by 400,000 students. Then you had
400,000 students. That's really significant in a country the size of Venezuela.
It's significant, but it's also challenging, because once they graduate, they all expect to find jobs. So that also puts another burden on the government and the economy to try to find jobs for now a highly educated population. Then you have identity missions to make sure everyone had identity cards, because you also had hundreds of thousands of immigrants who never had an identity card, so they were all legalized in Venezuela, something we still haven't seen here in the U.S.
The legalization of immigrants to the country, I had not heard that before.
Yeah, Venezuela drew immigrants from the Caribbean and drew immigrants from Colombia because its oil economy was the magnet. In other words, it attracted them during the 70s and 80s, during the time when Venezuela's economy was booming. Then you had cultural missions, music, theater, film, poetry. You had housing missions to create upwards of 700,000 homes for those who didn't have access to homes. And the investment in construction then helps boost the economy. And the economy, which everyone says is a disaster, actually grew by 5.5% last year.
Far better than the United States or most of Europe, isn't that correct?
More than Mexico, in fact, which is the darling of the U.S. In Latin America.
Well, let me tell the audience again, this is Linda Olson-Osterlund for KBOO, my show, A Deeper Look, and I'm talking with Miguel Tinker-Salas, a professor at Pomona in, College in Claremont, California, and an expert on Venezuela. Let's talk a little bit about the accusations of removing democracy. I know that there's been a human rights report that accuses Chavez's policies and goes through it very specifically of reducing, say, judicial independence, you know, that he legislated by decree, that there's been less freedom of the media. Let's talk about those kinds of Is he a despot, or did he forward democracy?
I think undoubtedly Venezuela saw a new political opening as a result of the election of Chavez. Was he a saint? No. Would I light candles to him? No. Is he a model? He was a model in Venezuela. I'm not sure you can apply anything that happened in Venezuela elsewhere. Every country has to come to its own political process, given its own internal conditions. But I think what the problem with the argument always is that he's a despot or a Democrat sort of creates this binary. He was neither one of the two full extremes. He falls somewhere in the middle. And he was a product of Venezuelan politics, and that's the reality. So that the idea somehow that Venezuela had an independent judiciary before Chavez is patently a lie. I mean, the reality is that there were cases of corruption that involved most presidents in Venezuela, their mistresses, their families. None of them were actually ever carried through in the judiciary system. So the notion somehow that on the one hand, Venezuela before Chavez was this perfect system where you had separation of powers is simply wrong. What Chavez did, and there's no doubt about it, had a top-down style of leadership. He came out of the military. He did personify this image tremendously. There's no doubt about it. There was a concentration of power under Chavez. But the flip side of that, and this is where the contradiction comes in, is that there was also tremendous empowerment of sectors of society that never had been empowered. Every election in Venezuela, we're talking about 14 different elections, were observed by the Carter Center, were observed by the OAS, the Organization of American States, was observed by the UNASUR, the Union of South America, was observed by the UE, the European Union, and everyone said that the elections were squeaky clean, actually much cleaner than elections anywhere else in the region, particularly Mexico, and even more so than the U.S., because it's through a touchscreen system in which you actually, as the voter, get a receipt that indicates how you voted, unlike what happens, say, in the U.S., we saw that in Florida in 2000, where you have no way of knowing how you voted in the end. So that there is a contradiction, no doubt, that in which there was a tremendous amount of centralization of power in Chavez's, but there was also an open democratic process, elections. There was a national assembly in which the opposition took part, in which they won seats. So I think, again, I would say that creating this binary of either despot or Democrat doesn't really fulfill where Chavez really falls in.
Yeah, I can see how it wouldn't, and I think that, you know, here we like to make fun of some of the things that he did, his weekly television show, Dancing with the People, having a parrot on his shoulder in some photos and some occasions, that kind of thing. But I think we also have to realize he wasn't talking to us.
That's right.
He was talking to the people of Venezuela, who very much, it was obvious from the looks on the faces of everyone around him, very much enjoyed his personality. And you could see the actual warmth and charisma that he projected. You can understand, you know, people like to say that about Bill Clinton, that if you were around him, his charisma was powerful. And I think that that's one of the things that's true about Hugo Chavez. That leaves me, though, with the following question. And this is one of the risks of ever increasing power in the hands of an executive branch, is when that executive goes, there the power stays for whoever the next one is. And with Hugo Chavez dying so far short of how long people hoped his legacy would be, at least those of his supporters, do you think the unique role that he played within Venezuela, let's just talk Venezuela right now, we'll get more into the region, do you think that can be carried forward by his chosen successor, Maduro?
I think it can. And we're going to have elections on April 14th, and I think you're going to see Chavismo without Chavez. And you already saw it taking shape as of last December. In last December, when there were elections for governors in Venezuela, the PSUV, the Socialist Party, United Socialist Party of Venezuela, won 20 of 23 governorships. In fact, winning 5 back from the opposition. And Chavez was not in the country. Chavez did not campaign, which underscores what I said earlier, that this is not about simply the figure of Chavez, although he was a central component. It's really about the fact that you have a new empowered electorate. And it's not just about getting gifts, as we heard Romney say, for the U.S. electorate, but it's about the fact that these social missions don't function unless you have actually participation by the citizens. They're the ones who make it work, and they're the ones who make it actually function. And I think you raised an earlier interesting point that when Chavez was speaking, he wasn't speaking to the U.S. audience. He was, in fact, speaking to a Venezuelan population, much the same way as the U.S. media, which always satirized and demonized him, is not speaking to a Venezuelan audience, but rather to a U.S. audience, and creating a model of public opinion. So I think that those are important issues.
Yeah, I saw that Saturday Night Live, Justin Timberlake, who has a lot of influence with young people, if you don't know who he is, he's a musical producer and singer, and he did a spoof of Elton John supposedly singing to at Chavez's funeral, and he mocked a lot of things that you could pull out from Chavez and put on the screen. But I can just think of, you know, Bill Clinton playing, what was it, the instrument that he would play on Saturday Night Live or on one of those shows. I mean, you can make anyone look like a buffoon. One of the ways that they've tried to demonize him was at the UN when he talked about the devil came here yesterday. I still smell the sulfur. But I can see the drama of his words, and that no one thought he was literally saying El Diablo in a spiritual sense rose from the ground, but that many people in the world who had been who have seen what U.S. warfare has done around it thought of Bush as the devil. In fact, many people in my audience would not mind calling him that.
Well, I think what you said was really a symbolic what he was mentioning. He wasn't really addressing the devil. But people tend to forget that when Chavez has said that statement, he had been called a Hitler by Donald Rumsfeld, the former Secretary of Defense. Pat Robertson had said the CIA should kill him. So this was not simply Chavez, you know, launching the first salvo. This was a war of words that had been going on between the administration and understanding that in 2002, the U.S. had greenlighted the coup. I mean, Ari Fleischer here, Secretary at that time, was spokesperson for the White House, was saying Chavez brought this upon himself and was already recognizing the coup government. So that in many ways, this was not simply Chavez, you know, again, saying some crazy statement, but it was the context. I mean, everything has a time, place, and condition in which that statement came into being.
Well, and it was well received by the delegates.
It's the first time I've seen people in the UN actually cracking up and laughing when he was making the statement. And the key point, though, was that how Chavez inserted himself into the international arena in ways that no other Venezuelan president had done. That's the most important thing. I mean,
let's talk about that a little bit more, too. Talk about the regional impact he had, the organizations that got revitalized with him and his allies in the region.
Well, the way to judge that, again, is to see where Venezuela was before Chavez. Before Chavez, Venezuela really was a non-entity within Latin America. It had no footprint. It had no presence. It saw itself as a U.S. ally, and it saw itself as providing energy to the U.S. and supporting the U.S. in the Cold War in every international institution, the United Nations, the OAS. What Chavez turns that around. And think about where the progressive or left-of-center movements were in Latin America, or even in the U.S. in 1998. Most of them have been reeling from a series of defeats after the demise after the end of the Berlin Wall and after the collapse of the left in the international arena. Here comes Chavez. And from an unlikely place, a country that had been known previously for exporting oil, winning senseless Miss Universe contests, and exporting baseball players, and all of a sudden he transforms Venezuela into a regional player, and that's actually in the constitution of Venezuela, that its goal is to create regional integration, and the first election was Venezuela in 1998, then followed shortly by Lula in Brazil, and then followed by the Kirchners and Fernandez in Argentina, and then in Uruguay, and then in Bolivia you have Evo Morales, the first indigenous president of Bolivia, then you have Rafael Correa, and you had at that time in Ecuador, then you had Michelle Bachelet in Chile, and then you create the conditions by which you can begin to transform the institutions in the region. And you begin seeing the formation of something called the CELAC, which was previously called the Rio Group. The CELAC is the Community of Latin American and Caribbean Nations, which meets and decides on major issues, has a regular summit. And again, Venezuela was an early proponent of that and does not include the U.S. or Canada. Then in South America, the presidents of South America, under initiative from Venezuela, formed something called the UNASUR, the Union of South American Nations. It includes all of the presidents of South America, with the idea of creating a Bank of the South, where countries could take out loans without the onerous conditions required from the IMF or the World Bank. And then you also had the creation of ALBA, the Bolivian Alliance for the Peoples of the America, which included all the countries of the Caribbean, many countries of the Caribbean, Cuba, and included countries in Honduras before Zelaya was ousted. So you have all these new institutions that give vitality, that give energy, and that give a different view of Latin America's position in the world. And in addition, you had Petrocaribe, an arrangement by which Venezuela could export oil to the Caribbean nations, including Haiti and Cuba and other nations, at reduced rates for interest rates. Not giveaway. It never gave away oil. It maintained the price of international oil, but allowed countries to sell them over longer-term credit rates and pay back in kind. So Cuba paid back by sending upwards of 18,000 doctors to Venezuela to service the mission system. So
that's what I was going to ask. There was a partnership with Cuba in that health mission, and so it was also part of this as well, then the lower-priced oil, which also saw its way to the United States, I believe, heating oil aid to poor people in the U.S.
Part of that was heating oil provided by Citgo, a Venezuelan subsidiary, that allowed for the people in the Bronx who had low income to get oil, also in Boston. And also remember that when Katrina hit, in fact, the Venezuelan government offered to send water treatment plants, offered to send oil, offered to send help because it had refineries in Louisiana. The Bush administration simply said no.
Now, in terms of the CELAC organization, as now that Hugo Chavez is dead, do you expect it to play the kind of role that it has been playing, and explain how that is. And I can't imagine that the United States has been happy or relaxed about these developments, and I can only assume that their efforts are going to increase to destabilize the kind of unity that an organization like this would have. Can you address that?
Sure. What we see in the case of the CELAC was they had a meeting in Santiago, Chile in January, in which Chavez was not present, but Maduro, which was at that time still acting vice president, previously had been the foreign minister, actually elected a new president, pro tem. They have a president pro tem that rotates around, and who did they elect? They elected Raul Castro from Cuba, a country that had been embargoed by the U.S., and even the president of Colombia, which is no ally of the left, and is probably one of the strongest allies the U.S. has in the region, Mr. Santos, said basically this is a symbolic act on our part to make sure that the world understands that we are independent and that we will chart our own course, and that Cuba is part of the community of nations of Latin America. So you see that the leadership is really a collegial leadership. In the case of the CELAC, it will include Cuba. It will subsequently include also Costa Rica. So you see that it's shared leadership. And what I expect to happen in the coming months and years will be a shared leadership. I don't think that Chavez's void will be replaced directly by one individual, but rather you'll see Morales from Bolivia, you'll see Correa from Ecuador, you'll see Dilma Rousseff from Brazil, where Brazil also has an interest in promoting regional integration and promoting its own set of interests. So those are all what I consider will happen in the next few months and years.
As we move forward in the world as a whole, we're facing a climate crisis, I believe, a threat of actual climate collapse, and Venezuela is one of the biggest oil, generators, producers. And then there's also Evo Morales, who really believes in the rights of not just indigenous people, but the rights of the Mother Earth. I think he's signed on to that very strongly. How do you see this future for the environment, and Venezuela being so dependent on oil for its source of income? Is that going to be a real clash as we move forward? Because many of us, who support environmental movements, of course, want to reduce the use of fossil fuels dramatically.
That's true. Venezuela continues to depend on oil the way it has since 1920s and 30s, when oil was first discovered. And oil causes tremendous distortions in the Venezuelan economy. It represents about 95% of all exports, and this is the principal source of revenue for the country in terms of dollars. So that is an ongoing issue. And although the country has attempted to reduce its own internal dependence, the government launched this whole campaign to change light bulbs, to ensure the reduction in the use of electricity and try to conserve water, etc. But again, it became highly politicized because then the opposition said that the government was restricting people's rights to have whatever they wanted. But it is an ongoing issue on which Venezuela will have to consider and involve itself because the question of the reduction of emissions and of pollutants is central. But oil has also left a tremendous stain on Venezuela because it's a really understudied issue in terms of how much oil has really impacted the very environment. We have oil spills on a regular basis. Oil is a dirty industry. There is simply no perfect way to extract oil, and invariably it has left an important stain on Venezuela's environment. Even though Venezuela has had a discourse about being supportive of environmental issues, it still has a long way to go.
So we don't know where that's going to come out. Well, tell us what you expect to happen in the most, upcoming future. We've got the election already scheduled for April 14th. The Constitution required it to have it within 30 days, I believe, and it's going forward with that. We have the candidate Vice President Maduro. He's a longtime chavista, is what you might say.
Chavista.
And with a lot of experience in a lot of different roles within the government there. His opposition is Capriles Radonsky. Yes.
Enrique Capriles Radonsky.
And he lost in his last battle up against Chavez, and he didn't, and his party has not done well in recent elections. What do you expect to see as this goes forward?
This election is going to be the shortest election. It's going to be the shortest campaign period, and it's going to probably be the most intense election we've seen in Venezuela in recent memory. We've already seen accusations and counter-accusations. Both candidates are using every opportunity they can as a campaign moment. It's unfortunate if they adopt a scorched earth policy, because in the end, the country still has to be governed. But increasingly, it's going to be a very contentious election. All the polls indicate that given the sympathy factor, and given what Chavez has done in the past, that it's likely that Maduro will be elected. Although I'm a bit reticent about making pronostications, because in the last election in October, Capriles Radonsky actually increased the number of votes that the opposition had received, increased it upwards of 6 million votes. The difference was 11 points, when previous elections actually had been as high as 18-point differences between the two candidates. But the opposition is united behind Capriles Radonsky. There are some of the traditional parties like Acción Democrática and COPEI that feel that they're being left behind in the process and that they're not being considered, so that there are some still divisions within the opposition. The opposition is also demoralized somewhat, because in many ways their argument had been that all Chavez supporters were there because they got gifts. But the outpouring that one saw with people participating in the funeral processions, etc., demonstrates that people came out of their own volition. So I think that they're a bit, in that sense, now trying to reassess where they're at. But this will be a very hotly contested election in the next few weeks.
Well, thank you very much. I've been speaking with Miguel Tinker Salas. He's professor at Pomona College. He has a book out right now that's called The Enduring Legacy, Oil, Culture, and Society in Venezuela. I'll link to that on the website. He has a forthcoming book, Venezuela, What Everyone Needs to Know. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. And people can always find me on my webpage, MiguelTinkerSalas.com.
That's right. And I will link to that as well on the website with this audio that will be uploaded later. Thank you to all of you for listening, and thank you to our wonderful engineer, Rock.
Hey, good morning from KBOO Portland. Coming up at 10:15 on Flashpoints, it's day 3 of special coverage of Fukushima 2 years later, featuring a presentation by Kevin Camps of Beyond Nuclear on 70 years of radioactive risk in Japan and the United States. At 11 on Between the Covers, host David Naiman interviews Sam Lipsight, author of the New York Times bestseller The Ask, about his new collection of stories called The Fun Parts. And at 11:30, Paula Small guest hosts Words and Pictures with guests from Stumptown Comics. But up next, it's Air Cascadia with Chris Andre, with headlines, interviews, and commentary. And that's coming up next on KBOO.
Tune in to Between the Covers every Thursday at 11 a.m. to hear interviews with locally and nationally known authors from both fiction and nonfiction. Between the Covers, only on KBOO Portland.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Thursday, March 14th, 2013. That's 314, right? 13. It's Pi Day. And you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. Amanda Fritz managed to lead the charge to drive home mandatory sick leave for workers. Now, if we could only afford to see a doctor. And Obama plans for spy agencies to have total access to Americans' financial information. Most Americans don't have any financial information because they don't have any money, and the ones that do are already inside. And farther afield, the Afghani people staged a rally in a protest on behalf of Bradley Manning. Yes, it's spreading. And the National Weather Service has this for us. Pretty much the same old overcast skies today. The possibility of rain coming in this afternoon with a high near 58. And tonight, look for showers early on, lows around 49. Tomorrow, grey skies are with us again with a high near 59. And Friday night, overcast and lows around 47. The alternative forecast, we have a waxing crescent leaf moon in Pisces. The moon is 2 days old, and everything that we've mentioned in the last two or three days basically is holding steady. Leafy vegetables and annuals, planting grains. Mustard makes a terrific cover crop. And that's it for both the traditional and the conventional and the alternative forecast. We are very fortunate right now to have Jeff Patterson online with the Bradley Manning Support Network. A lot is happening right now. Good morning, Jeff. Thanks for being with us today on short notice.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for having me on the air.
Well, the interesting thing about the audio that has created such a brouhaha, the media, I think that if Chase Manor had access to transcripts of Bradley Manning's emails in which he clearly and repeatedly states his motivation, yet the mainstream media went nuts over the audio. Finally, we heard Bradley Manning explaining why he did it in his own voice. It was all there. It must have been. Manor wrote about it. So all of a sudden, they're having this eureka epiphany sort of moment. It seems